90.3 FM, Montreal.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Son, see how you doing? Come back to earth, homie. Hip hop is in ruins. I'm a third of the club, but I'ma speak for the click. What up, though? We miss you, kid. What the city say?
GD, flip another beat for me. GD, GD, flip another beat for me. GD, GD, flip another beat for me. GD, GD, flip another beat for me. GD.
Yo, yo, beat-wise, you still at cat, which most should be measured. I'm that MC known that she has displeasure with the route the game is taking. How mundane things have got. You know, music on a whole. Never mind, just hip-hopping. I'm in the club 3 hours in chains. DJ spinning top 40. We be hearing all day. Some MC be catalog. And yeah, they stay paid. But why pay over $1 when they lip-syncing on stage? King of pop, Barry White, rolling over.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And good evening and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're 6 days into the month of February and we are broadcasting live from an unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. Kev here with you. And I'm co-hosting today alongside Zoe.
Hello.
And pushing the buttons as always, Ben. To top off the hour, some community listings, then a main segment of the hour, the second part of our roundtable discussion on Bell's Let's Talk campaign led by Zoe. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the time is now 5:04. And first up, here are some community listings.
The Disabled Women's Network Canada is hosting dance workshops for women with disabilities. The workshops will run every Wednesday at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. from March 20th to June 15th, 2019. The workshops will foster an accepting environment and will provide accommodations. There's a free trial workshop taking place next Wednesday, February 13th, at 5:30 at Circuit Est on 2022 Sherbrooke Street East. For more information, you can check out Dawn Canada's Facebook page. Mental Health and First Aid Australia is recruiting participants from across the world to contribute their knowledge for a research project. The information provided will help develop guidelines on how to approach mental health and first aid to a person with an intellectual disability. You will be asked to complete 3 online surveys of around over 4 to 6 months, and the total estimated time commitment is approximately 2 to 3 hours. To find out more about the project and whether you are eligible to contribute, please contact Farih Kotil at Mental Health First Aid Australia. That's F-A-I-R-L-I-E-C at mhfa.com.au. And that's all for community listings. Coming up next, a roundtable discussion on Bell Let's Talk campaign. But first, we're going to play a tune and then an ad.
D'épicerie pour griser mon ennui de le prix de ma fuite. Ça mélamine de ma cuisine. J'entrevois mon cœur en ruine dans une cage de cartilage entre la boucane et les nuages. De deux poumons fumant de rage, la vinasse nage dans mon œsophage. Pied dans la tranche, je m'attrache à ce boy par une plaque de plomb forgé qui traverse ma gorge et m'empêche d'épancher toute parole orale. Je ravale, j'essaye de parler, mais la corolle, la fleur du mal se referme, je me renferme, les mots pourris au fond de mon abysse thoracique. Oh, je cherche d'attaquer mes joints toxiques que dans mon esprit la taxi sévit et c'est sans préavis. Saisis d'impatience, je dis la science infuse qui me dicte le fusée. Désobéissance a choisi l'errance et la sentience. Des lumières flashent où je danse, des lumières flashent où je danse. Dans ma transance, en transe, je danse, je danse. Je connais ton corps et colle ma langue sur ton cou. Exemple, je goûte de ton goût. Faut qu'il revienne le sens de l'existence.
To the Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is now 5:13. Our main segment today is part two of our discussion on Bell Let's Talk. To recap, if you haven't heard all of the massive amounts of advertising, Bell Let's Talk is a subsidiary charity associated with telecom giant Bell. Though the charity was launched in September 2010, the first annual Bell Let's Talk Day occurred in January 2011. During the campaign, Bell encourages its customers to call and text using services, as well as post on social media using the hashtag BellLet'sTalk. For every interaction, Bell donates 5 cents to Canadian mental health programs. With every year, the scope of the campaign and the money raised for public engagement grows. Organizations they help contribute funding to include Kids Help Phone, CAMH, and Douglas Mental Health Hospital here in Montreal. Despite the outward appearance of charity, Bell Let's Talk is not without its flaws. We will be discussing some of these criticisms on today's show with this panel. As listeners may know, my name is Zoe. I go by they, them pronouns, and I co-host The Avalanche. I'm a queer, mad artist, and I have been in the mental health care system the majority of my life.
Hi, my name is Vincent Musso. I am a social work student here at McGill University. My pronouns are they and them, and I am a Black, queer, and trans community organizer, activist, involved mainly in causes around racial justice and anti-assimilationist queer activism against marriage and military service. I'm also a person living with mental illness. I have borderline personality disorder, and I also do some, I also have some anxieties about from time to time.
Hello, I'm Johanna. I'm a third-year student at McGill University, and I go by they or she pronouns. I recently wrote an article for McGill Tribune where I'm a staff writer on mental illness, especially mental health services at McGill, and how they aren't living up to the need that we have at our school.
And we will also be joined by Adriana later in the show. Today's show, we will be further discussing some of the topics regarding Bell Let's Talk, such as the numbers from this year's Bell Let's Talk Day, how and where Bell distributes the funds, problems with targeting only stigma around mental health, and the lack of intersectional approach of the campaign, as well as the injustices in prisons that Bell is involved in and the irony of police participation in the campaign. To recap, last week we talked about the basics of the campaign, how corporate sponsorship is not a healthcare system, the problematic aspects of having mentally ill people publicly beg for healthcare, the problematics of Bell as a company, the publicity of the campaign, the funding, and some aspects of its lack of intersectional approach. So in 2019, last week, Bell had $445,440,699 interactions, with a total of 7,272,134.95 raised. Social media this year was up 13% in comparison to the 2018 campaign, and the total campaign donation is around $100 million. Bell Let's Talk was the top Twitter trend in Canada and worldwide. So who did you guys see promoting the campaign this year?
I know Ellen DeGeneres did a big video on it that everyone shared.
Mm-hmm. I think there's been a lot of promotional work being done by larger and larger celebrities. So mm-hmm. showing that this campaign is really working for Bell. So I think off the top of my head, I remember seeing Alessia Cara, Ellen DeGeneres, of course. Seth Rogen, I believe, was also involved.
Yeah, I saw that tweet.
Yeah.
He was in some of the Bell promotional materials like too. Yeah. And what I noticed is that there is a lot more international artists and mm-hmm. public figures. Whereas in comparison, there was a lot more Canadian focus. So in addition to previous year, this year, again, Justin Trudeau promoted the campaign. The Governor General promoted the campaign. But what I found was also weird is that the royal family tweeted about Bell Let's Talk Day, which is just just wild, absolutely wild to have that cognitive dissonance of you created the system that is responsible for so much global suffering and then be like, hashtag mental health.
Sitting in a room of like literally everything made of gold and just being like, I don't know what these poors are talking about. like what? Like you're completely right. The cognitive dissonance that it takes to be able to tweet those kinds of things.
It was
absolutely absurd.
It continues in something that we talked about in the last rendition of this panel, is that you see people with so much global influence who most likely have never experienced things like this because they have access and influence in order to receive privatized healthcare. And then to be like, oh, okay, let's contribute in this thing where mentally ill people have to publicly beg. So let's talk about where the money has been going. So out of the $7.2 million, some of the money this year, $200,000 to be clear, is going to the Bear Clan Patrol and Stronger Families Institute in Winnipeg. However, this is both a collaboration with Bell and the City of Winnipeg. Bell is not disclosing exactly how much they're providing, as Bell does. Here in Montreal, UQAM is getting $500,000. The Welcome Hall Mission, Old Brewery Mission, and Accueil Bonneau are getting $300,000 combined, and all of them work with homeless communities. So it feels like a step in the right direction. Some of these partnerships are part of Bell's Community Fund, in which organizations directly apply for, meaning these organizations apply to them in the year of 2018 in order to receive money for 2019. Bell doesn't state the amount that they give specifically to community funds, again, in Bell style, nor do they state how much individual grants are worth. So the money that they allocate to specific community funds is very much on Bell's whims. So some examples of these grants from 2018 are Big Brothers and Big Sisters in North Durham, Ontario, the BYTE in Whitehorse, which is getting money for additional suicide prevention training, as well as funding for the New Carlisle community in Quebec on the Gaspé coast. There are approximately 8,000 people on the Bay Coast unable to access scarce mental health care services, and this organization will use Bella's Talk funding to develop a partnership with local health agencies to deliver a series of awareness targeting sessions in English-speaking and Indigenous communities in the region. They need services, but Bell is only giving them a one-time grant, which is something we briefly touched on the last episode, that funding is not necessarily secure by any means.
I think something important to note as well in terms of that is that the funding is meant for use for awareness campaigns and not necessarily for the provision of services. And I think this is something that is very indicative of the way that Bell does this, right? So Bell talks a big game about how mental health services are so important and like raising awareness. But they are all they're only stipulations for funding is that they continue to raise awareness about mental health issues and not necessarily improve the system as it exists, which creates a whole bunch of problems. I mean, we can raise awareness about what's going on in New Carlisle, and I think it's extremely important to do so, especially for Indigenous and English-speaking communities in the Gaspé. However, awareness is not going to make mental health practitioners and social workers and the folks that are doing that vital work randomly appear out of thin air. And Bell has shown time and time again that they're not doing the lobbying effort, that they're not actually taking the concrete steps to pressure government services in order to actually create substantive social change in these communities. Which, what does that say?
And speaking about anti-stigma, anti-stigma campaigns can be super effective. I'm not denying that they aren't, but they can be counterproductive. So looking at the positives, reviews have examined the impact of stigma on access to the mental health care system and concluded that stigma has had a significant detrimental effect. However, again, because of the nature of these studies, it can't be targeted to specific populations.
Sure.
Now onto the long list of cons, because holy shit, there are a lot. There's some evidence that stigma campaigns, or anti-stigma campaigns rather, can be effective, but they're almost always regarding knowledge and attitudes, but not for behavioral outcomes. So essentially, people can talk the Bell Let's Talk, dare I say, but they can't walk the Bell Let's Walk.
Sure.
Nice. Nice. I think it's important to maybe, I want to like localize and contextualize this within some experiences that I've had here at McGill and McGill's active involvement within the Bell Let's Talk campaign. Walking into the Brown Student Center, for folks who are familiar with McGill, where many of the now fleeting mental health services that this university offers are located, we see walls and walls full of student initiatives on how we can improve our mental health. With, of course, Bell Let's Talk branding all over it. These things are absolutely absurd. I mean, one of them literally said, do yoga. Easy.
Perfect.
Like,
solved.
Like, problem solved. Yeah, thanks. I guess I'm not going to have to worry about any of the mental health issues that I'm coming here to see my psych about now that I just saw a sign that suggested that I do yoga. Like, literally, no.
Yeah, and I know another thing is, too, a lot of the, you know, promotional posts that people do are, you know, about sort of publicized, and people are starting to become more aware of, like, depression, anxiety. But then I work at a homeless shelter. These people deal with schizophrenia. You know, that's less accepted in society, and no one's talking about it, and that stigma isn't being reduced.
Yeah, I think what are the types of conversations that we are having around mental health? And we see that they are, of course, very facile and focused on a very specific picture of what mental health issues are. But what are the conversations that we're facilitating? Because what the prompt is from Bell is like, let's talk. Because ultimately, they don't care what you talk about. They want you to use their name in the hashtag. That's what the importance is, right? And it leads to facile conversations which erase the realities that folks with mental illness live. A huge problem of that being the fact that these posters and the way that people go about having these conversations are so uninformed that they actually end up contributing to the stigma that they aim to fight.
And they also feel kind of performative too. Like people aren't actually doing what they say they're going to do. Mm-hmm.
And Adriana, do you have something to add? Also, Adriana, welcome.
Hey guys. Another problem that comes along with like solely focusing on stigma is that it puts forward this idea that beyond negative stereotypes, people's mental illness experience little or no actual behavioral consequences. And that's all that Bell really does. They focus on this idea of awareness, this idea of like anti-stigma, which is very like palatable, I'd say, to the general public, as opposed to being on actual like political change as like something that they should be focusing on. And this subject is elaborated upon further in Michael Gallagher's opinion piece in McMaster's newspaper, The Silhouette, if you guys want to learn more about it.
Yeah, so he said that outlining anti-stigma, not anti-discrimination, as one of the campaign's four pillars, it undervalues and potentially ignores the existence of mental health discrimination. So they're focused very much on the public opinions of mental health, but not the actual lived experiences, which it's important that to note that anti-stigma campaigns can actually reinforce people's stigma-based responses. So by talking about anti-stigma in the way that Bell facilitates, for example, Bell talking about, oh, sometimes people can fire you for being for exhibiting symptoms of mental illness. That in turn facilitates that public discussion of employers and them saying like, oh, this is a possibility, we can just do this, which just goes to show that talking about something does not equal concrete action. So you can know that, for example, psychosis exists, but it doesn't mean you know the details of disorder. It doesn't mean you know the experience of the disorder. And it's also really important to consider in all of this that there are no long-term studies on the practical effectiveness of anti-stigma campaigns in regards to seeking care. So the fact that we're talking about it doesn't equal people actually getting to care. Campaigns like Bell's have occurred for multiple years. However, the conversation regarding anti-stigma is always concentrated on one day. It's not necessarily long-term.
Yeah, and I think there's something really interesting about anti-stigma work as well, and in, just about the way that it removes the responsibility from people to actually inform themselves about these issues. And so it really puts the onus on people who are facing the prejudice in the first place to end the discrimination that they face. So as folks living with mental illness, we are constantly forced to share our stories and our most like deeply like painful and intimate experiences to the general public just so that we can be considered people. And I think, as we said in our last episode, like beg for the very crumbs so that people will take us seriously.
It's 5 cents.
Yeah.
To be specific.
It's trauma porn, basically. It's this idea of like, you need to legitimize yourself and
commodifying our pain.
Exactly. And all for the goal of promoting a company, which I think makes it all the more insulting.
And people feel better when they hashtag this, but they're not doing anything in their personal lives.
There's also something very specific about these public discussions around mental health that I specifically have been noticing within the last few years is the concept of self-care. But self-care in the terms of Twitter or Tumblr or Facebook or whatever is watered down to be a very capitalistic approach. So self-care has now become synonymous with the consumption of products.
Oh, I got a lot about this. So I literally just got out of a class. So as a social work student, as you can imagine, we talk a lot about self-care. And the focuses of the self-care that are promoted are very similar to the one I mentioned earlier. You know, just do yoga and you'll be better. But the reality is these things are, I mean, this model of self-care was very clearly created for privileged cisgender white women in the ways in which they interact with things, right? So, I mean, the audacity of saying to someone, for example, who just had to enforce the violence of the system and take away a black child from their parents and place them in the foster care system, knowing full well the impact of that on the parent's mental health, the child's mental health, and all of the other aspects that they have, because this is the way the system works, telling them to go and take a bubble bath is an absolute insult to the work that social workers have to do, and it's just absurd. And also it's so privileged because like literally we're getting tips like try to make some time to go on a vacation. You know what happens if I go on a vacation? I don't make enough money to pay my rent.
Yeah.
Like these are the kinds of conversations that we need to be talking about in terms of self-care.
Like the term self-care actually arose in academic communities in the 80s, specifically for patients primarily in the mental health field to add to their treatment in conjunction with care from like doctors, medication, pharmacists. But now it's, again, very much synonymous with consumption of products that is primarily catered towards people who have the ability to take time off to buy like $50 worth of like bath bombs every single month. And it like products like those can specifically regarding like the physical product can be DIY'd, but almost all of them are connected to a brand. And then those brands have capitalized on this, which again is reflected in just the concept of Bell Let's Talk Day in general. You see vulnerable populations and you see a need for seeking retrieve from these fucked up systems. And instead of thinking, let's find out how we can alleviate pressures on those systems, they think, how can we make a profit?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, but I feel like in general, it also just like normalizes this idea of coping with whatever your situation is rather than working to try and eliminate or lessen stressors in your life whenever possible. Like I see this a lot. I'm in university, so I see this a lot among students where they push themselves to these extremes, like poor diet and like going on like an hour of sleep for like 3 days in a row. And then they go and attend these self-care workshops like it's an adequate solution to protect them from the harms that this type of like lifestyle will incur when clearly it isn't. So it's used as kind of this like, I don't know, solution, but it doesn't actually change the harmful effects of the problem.
Mm-hmm. There was this article I read earlier today in which the Canadian Mental Health Association, they published a blog post encouraging their readers, which again, mentally ill folks, to practice good mental health at work by creating a wellness box. And things included in this box were coloring books, perfect, journaling prompts, tea, and essential oils, which just, oh my God.
So I definitely agree. I think for the vast majority of folks, this does infantilize care, right? I mean, also like, I mean, as a person living with borderline personality disorder who's gone through dialectical behavioral therapy, this is a technique that is actually taught in DBT. But it's not this infantilizing. It's not it's a thing about like find items that are important to you and that will help you calm down in a situation of crisis and things like that. Not take a coloring book and deal with it kind of thing, which was the general gist of that article, which is doubly, insulting considering the reality. And I think largely one of the issues that I have with this is the way that it individualizes the idea of self-care.
Yeah.
Especially in racialized communities and in marginalized communities in general, community development and building community together is an integral part of self-care. It's so key. And I remember one of the most healing experiences that I had around trauma was after two Black folks were killed in the same week by the police in the United States, and the Black community in Montreal got together and we were able to unite together, have conversations that were open and honest about our feelings that we never would have been able to cope with on an individualistic kind of level. And I think this is not the kind of self-care that is valued by educational, quote unquote, educational campaigns like this, or even within mainstream education around what self-care is in general. And in doing so, I think these actually, one could argue that these actually perpetuate the very forms of marginalization that contribute to disproportionate rates of mental illness within racialized communities and marginalized communities in general.
Mm-hmm. So, Joanna, you wrote a Tribune article this week specifically about McGill's system. So three out of four of us go or have gone to McGill. So we can specifically vouch for the absolute
terrible
Wild West system of healthcare that they are providing.
Yeah.
So do you want to give us some examples?
Yeah. So I wrote this article in response to Well Week, which the McGill administration started up this year as sort of like a Bell Let's Talk Week, essentially, of wellness and mental wellness. And a lot of the events were like mason jar, like meal hacks, you know, they taught you how to bullet journal. Suzanne Fortier promoted the yoga that they were going to have. And, you know, while this was going on, I had just gone through, you know, trying to get into the McGill mental health clinic and being told that I had to wait 6 weeks, and I was in a really bad place. And I think this just felt so insulting. And this is something that all students face. And I mean, you know, you go into the center and they tell you, oh, well, you know, you can come by for drop-in hours, but 5 minutes into the day, they're full for drop-in hours. And you just see these people walking out with like tears in their eyes because they feel so mm-hmm. like they have no safety line to cling to, essentially.
And what has just been absolutely baffling me by the McGill situation is that they're cutting so many vital programs that provide active counseling.
Yeah.
Because it's important to recognize that like peer support and quote unquote, like lighter methods of care and wellness are important. They're very vital.
Yeah.
But to someone suffering psychosis, it's important to have active treatment,
yeah.
active psychotherapy, active psychiatry, the access to medication. And the system McGill has created and is cutting is that avenues such as that are being completely eliminated.
Yeah, like the eating disorder program cared for 17 students. And, you know, having an eating disorder, you need care, you need rehabilitation therapy, and they just cut it.
I think one of the most pressing things for me, and maybe it's a little bit of a sidebar, but like what do these like older white women think that yoga and like exercise bikes actually do?
not a lot.
Like, well, we know that it's not a lot. Like, we understand, of course, the very basics, but mm-hmm. it's just like fix your brain chemistry by like biking in Redpath and riding the treadmill that they put in the Schulich Library, you know, while we actively cut your services. I think like the amounts, I mean, of course, I know this isn't about McGill specifically, but I think like so many universities are actively cutting within these services because it's much easier and cheaper, and it makes you look like you care a lot more when you're able to actually put in physical infrastructure that looks pretty that you can use in your promotional materials.
Oh, yeah.
Say that you're promoting student wellness. So McGill's example, it's the Rossi
Student Wellness
Center, which whose name I don't even care about because it's just so irrelevant. But I mean, at so many other universities are doing the same thing. When I was at the University of Ottawa, they had this student center that they created that was meant to do the same thing, and it's the same thing that Bell Let's Talk does. So when we talked about it last week, the fact that Rogers donates three times the amount that Bell does to charitable causes, yet Bell is the one that's seen as being on the front lines in terms of mental health work community outreach more generally. Yeah. It's the same dynamic that's playing itself out, and I think people are noticing it. It's just insulting because it is a co-option of the very real fights that folks with mental illness have been struggling with for so long.
Yeah. And I know at McGill, a lot of the focus is on like prevention and also supplementing therapy, but they don't even provide the basic therapy that students need. And when a student, you know, goes into a crisis, they need that like immediate assistance. They can't go to a spin bike and just solve their problems.
And I think this reminds me of something that was published in the McGill Daily. They had a statistic that said, quote, if 10% of the student body sought services, one clinician would have to see 174 students. This is how completely unprepared the university is for this, for the needs of the student body. And people know it. And people do not access services as a result of this. Like, we have individual support networks happening. I'm involved with the Social Work Student Association, and some of our first year students knew so well what happened with McGill mental health services that they started a collective where they're getting together, doing meal preparation together, so that whenever there are issues with anxiety and things like that, and you don't really feel as though you're able to eat healthily, that you'll have food available for you. Like, these are the kinds of beautiful networks of solidarity that are being formed. But they shouldn't have to be being formed at an institution like McGill.
That's something that's very much not being considered, is that McGill talks about, oh, if we build this Rossi Student Wellness Hub, it'll alleviate pressure on actual medical services, on counseling services. Well, if you're eliminating those services, what's the point? It isn't a well-known fact because McGill is very much trying to bury this information, but they are cutting the psychiatry program. They're cutting the psychology program. They're no longer providing psychotherapy to McGill students. So that means McGill students, by the nature of the student care system, of the insurance system that McGill provides, have to go see private help. And if you can't afford that, that means you have to suffer with that. And for the longest time, that's what I had to do because my psychiatrist had numerous complaints about her. I had to leave, but I knew that if I needed medication, I had to stay within the system because I couldn't afford anything else.
Also remembering that McGill exists within its community, right? So as a student in the School of Social Work, for example, we have, for example, a domestic violence clinic, which has significant reach within the community. We're one of the only folks that are doing, like schools that are doing that kind of research on domestic violence and also providing frontline services simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the way, but I, again, in involvement with the McGill Social Work Student Association has given me access to seeing some of the basics of the budget of the School of Social Work, and it's absolutely absurd. And you can see the way in which McGill's priorities in terms of financial things do not actually focus on the wellness of students here, but also of their place within the community, with the ways in which these services are chronically underfunded,
mm-hmm.
right? This does not only exist in terms of the services that are offered to students, but the services that McGill departments offer to the community at large.
Yeah.
Important to take into account because McGill does take a lot of pride in the way that they are actively involved within the community, right? They're trying to fight this idea that we're just a whole bunch of isolated Anglos that hang out mm-hmm. on a mountain, you know? and so, yeah.
And they're doing this also while cutting essential community programs. Like, they completely cut SEED out of the blue without consultation from not only the working groups within SEED, but also the greater McGill community.
Yeah.
Good thing we have Eugène Devy.
Yeah, perfect. Let's do some yoga, guys.
If I just stopped taking performance-enhancing drugs like caffeine and cigarettes, which I think about that every day. Just the fact that Olivia Dien, which, for those unaware, was the ex-deputy provost of McGill.
Thankfully.
thought that cigarettes were performance-enhancing drugs. And again, placing the blame on the individual rather than the systemic situation that McGill creates.
Yeah, completely shifting the blame.
And again, this is mirrored in the greater anti-stigma campaigns, like Bell, for example. So you have them saying, we're a champion in mental health, we're a champion in workplace mental health, for example. But they treat their employees disposably, not providing health care, creating poor conditions that they cannot escape through without access to health care, adequate aftercare. And because of the financial situation that we're living in, we're just forced to endure. So there's this quote from Canada Land that I would like to share with you guys. Young people, women, and people of color are told that they need to suffer the indignities of entry-level positions to pay their dues. Crying takes place in washrooms or in cars. And low pay with no benefits is often accepted as the cost of entry. For many, casual contract and hourly work is a necessary stepping stone or means to pay basic bills, especially when layoffs or closures continue to mount. And this was specifically in regards to Bell. So you have employees that are actively suffering, yet Bell says, we're taking an active leadership position in workplace mental health. And it's just absolutely wild.
Yeah, I think this relates a lot to something that I've been talking about quite a bit. So, as a person who's formerly worked in call centers for these larger companies, for one of Bell's competitors, but having friends who work for Bell, knowing that the dynamic is still the same, there are a disproportionate number of racialized employees that end up there for various reasons. I think it's very integral also that we think about the ways that Bell Let's Talk's campaign and their workplace practices have disproportionately harmful effects on racialized people.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that is an employee, whether these are employees being insulted by staff members and customers mm-hmm. with racial slurs and all these things and having no adequate services to deal with it, as the Canada Land article mentioned, to something that in my racial justice work stood out a lot about the Bell Let's Talk campaign. The ways in which I saw Bell Let's Talk tweeting at the Toronto police, saying that saying that they're so thankful to have them, and even created a specific graphic with a police person, that little bell like stick font thing that they do. Absolutely absurd. And I think it's really integral that we think about, for example, the fact that on Bell Let's Talk Day, Greg Ritchie, a 30-year-old Indigenous man with mental health issues, was on his way to get his medication at a pharmacy and was shot and killed by the Ottawa police just days after the Bell Let's Talk Day, and the Ottawa Police Service's active participation therein. Actually, pretty sure it was on Bell Let's Talk Day, and it happened to go after.
And the Ottawa police had tweeted about Bell Let's Talk.
Mm-hmm.
And
on
then
the same day.
It's disgusting.
And then go on and murder someone in active mental health crisis. And he's by no means the only example. People like in Canada, Andrew Locu, Pierre Collignon, Abdelrahia Abdi, were shot by police while in mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. So Bell is here to talk awareness that police are stressed or something. Why are they participating in this while receiving no training in how to do it and not addressing any of the other institutional problems within the policing force?
Again, it's so performative. They have no concept of what it actually means to help people with mental health crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak specifically to the experiences in Montreal around Pierre Carrielan, a black man in mental health crisis in the village in Montreal. And the ways that the police interacted with this person and the significant lack of awareness around mental health issues, coupled with the virulent anti-blackness of the SPVM, mm-hmm. led to a situation that was extremely violent. And this mirrors, again, something I believe that I said on last week's show, but in the United States, we don't have the data about it in Canada, but we can imagine that it's very similar. Mm-hmm. 50% of black people killed by the police are living with mental illness. That is not a negligible statistic. And the lack of intersectionality within Bell's campaign actually ends up furthering that. We see it in a lot of community organizations, right? The way that racialization is separated from queer identity, for example, is mm-hmm. separated from belonging in Quebec, specifically belonging in the nation, right? This idea of where are you really from? Reed, why are you black? And of course, in this regard, the rampant ableism and mental health stigma, and the way that none of it actually addresses the issues that racialized communities face, is just an absolute clusterfuck. And it's infuriating because there's no critical analysis behind mm-hmm. it. And yeah, like you can throw as much money as you want at Indigenous service organizations who are doing, don't get me wrong, vital work within communities, but also support an organization which shot and kills a black man on the day, an Indigenous man on the same day that you're promoting yourself as this leader in mental health services. It's absolutely fucking unacceptable, and there needs to be more action taken around these kinds of things and pointing out Bell's hypocrisy, which has been happening in the media more and more, thankfully, mm-hmm. this year.
And specifically regarding like policing, racialized people and specifically black people are more likely to be killed by police in crisis. So it's rather than accessing care, you see multiple white people in crisis transferred to prison. But what the police view is that racialized people in crisis are best helped with a gun. And that's so incredibly fucked up mm-hmm. that the limit to care is they would rather not help people in crisis because they are racialized. And that's an institutional problem that a tweet by the Ottawa police promoting Bell does not address. A simple hashtag does not address. And even if it were, there was a specific hashtag in regards to educating police and changing the system, you have to begin to implement that, which it's a systemic problem in the way policing is set up, in the way policing is executed, in the way that the prison system works, in the way that the prison system limits access to care. And specifically regarding that, let's tackle the mammoth that is Bell's influence on the prison call system.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack
because
here.
Because there is so much. I went through so many court documents. Unsurprisingly, they were all blanked out because Bell requires that. But essentially, Bell charges abhorrently high fees for phone calls to and from correctional facilities, which raises financial strains on family, taking a huge toll on them and their mental health, which again, it's super hypocritical of Bell to promote mental health while actively profiting off the inmates' families. And it's not just Bell. The governments, the provincial governments, are profiting off of these phone calls.
There's a really interesting quote that we were able to dig up from the Halifax Inquirer that says, quote, "At the same time as we're celebrating how much money Bell raised for mental illness awareness and treatment, we're not talking about the millions that they make from the fact that that so many mentally ill people who cannot get treatment or intervention, especially those from racialized, impoverished, and marginalized communities, end up incarcerated and, as one of the articles on prison phone contracts phrased it, a quote-unquote captive market for Bell," end quote.
So specifically in how much they charge. So just to provide a baseline statistic, making unlimited calling in Ontario for a household phone line is $13.90 a month. In Ontario prison, the province-wide rate is $1.25 a minute and $25 for 20 minutes. And these are only allowed from cell phones, so that means the fee increases if you're trying to contact people without them, which is a very real possibility. Not everyone has a cell phone. When looking into these documents, we found that the government makes a commission. So lawyer Michael Spratt obtained documents that show the government gets a commission from every collect call made from provincial jails.
I think we might have made a tiny bit of a mistake. Ooh. The phone calls from prisons are actually only allowed to call home to call landline phones.
Oh, yes,
landline
sorry.
Phones. So anyone without a landline phone cannot be done, which I think is actually adds to the situation because literally I know no one with a landline phone, like nobody at all.
Absolutely.
But yeah, they've been profiting off of this since 1997. Bell issues these commissions to the government monthly. Unfortunately, due to the legality of an ongoing case, I couldn't find the exact value of the contract, which would have been stellar to expose them. But the redactions are incredibly telling. To quote Spratt, "What we often say in law is that it looks like a consciousness of guilt when you're trying to hide something. I wonder if the government feels a bit guilty about this revenue system."
I think another really interesting thing, and I have a tendency to keep bringing this back to racialization because this is my work.
It's awesome.
I think it's really important that we can also consider the disproportionate rates of racialized people that and folks with mental illness generally who find themselves within solitary confinement. And very specifically with this, understanding the ways that that Bell actively limits their communications to the outside world. So people in solitary confinement are not allowed to make phone calls. In fact, a study mm-hmm. in Pelican Bay State Prison reported that 63% of men kept in solitary confinement for 10 to 28 years said they consistently felt that they were on the verge of a quote-unquote impending breakdown, compared to 4% of individuals in maximum security prisons, reporting that 73% of people in solitary confinement felt chronically depressed, compared to 48% of those in maximum security settings. The ministry does allow jails to waive the fees in case of family illness, injury, or death, but we have no actual data on how mm-hmm. often that actually happens. And considering the extreme violence of the prison industrial complex as it exists, we can imagine that it's actually not that often.
Mm-hmm. And again, they have control over how many calls in which what they classify as a serious case of illness, what they classify as an injury. And again, inmates in solitary confinement don't have access to that. Mm-hmm. So it just blows my mind.
I had no idea.
The fact that they can create this public years-long campaign while actively profiting off of inmates.
And the government profits, too.
The government profits off of this.
It's disgusting.
Well, it makes a lot more sense why Justin Trudeau is now tweeting Bell Let's Talk now, doesn't
yeah,
it?
He feels guilty. Mm-hmm.
I think there's something, I know that I'm aware that we don't probably have that much time left, but I think it's really important to mention to mention a lawsuit that was launched in 2017 challenging these predatory charges very specifically. So being sued by Joey Zucran, a lawyer, about collect calls within prisons. So there was a woman who was charged over $157 for 12 collect calls over the span of a few months. Her son was in prison less than 80 kilometers away in the same area code in Quebec. The rates also go against the Quebec Consumer Protection Act, which specifically states that consumers need to be told rates before entering a contract. The collect call rates are not displayed on Bell's website. They specifically say varies by area, therefore going against the Consumer Protection Act. The lawsuit's currently awaiting an authorizational hearing, so it'll be a while before we know if anything comes of this, but we thought it was really important to mention this so that folks are aware of the predatory ways in which Bell gouges quote-unquote clients. I guess they kind of have to be.
Yeah, they have
unwilling
to.
Unwilling clients in the prison system, and the ways in which it's not only the people in prisons but also their loved ones who are being disproportionately affected by this. So yeah, and I mean, just doing a quick search of Google and like Bell and lawsuit on Google will show you that there's tons
there are
of files.
So many more that I just like glanced through, but I'm like, if this is just a legal show, maybe.
Yeah.
But the sheer amount would cover at least 50 shows.
Totally. And I mean, they're just for doing things like misleading customers, not informing them of charges, and the stress that you have to take off time and like just to be able to address all of these issues with their terrible customer service. Like, these are all active contributors to these things. These are all active contributors to all of these, to the very issues that Bell says that they like to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess luckily all of y'all are still having conversations about mental illness, right? I mean, that wasn't just a thing for January 30th, because I haven't seen it on Facebook. I haven't seen anyone talking about anything relating to mental illness after.
Am
I the only one?
You're only allowed to be mentally ill on January 30th.
One day, you guys.
Oh, that's lucky for me. That's my day.
I only need to take meds one day a year, and then I'm no longer mentally ill.
Bless.
Thank you, Bell.
Thank you so much, Bell.
Thank you, Overlord Bell.
And, thanks everyone for joining us today in studio.
As we discussed, Bell Let's Talk raises a lot of publicity regarding anti-stigmatizing mental illness. It's important to acknowledge that one day, January 30th this year, or a few weeks, or even just funding schemes aren't enough. The conversation cannot be in the hands of a corporation, and we as people with mental illness, as well as our allies, need to take the conversation in our own hands. We need to have these conversations. We need to have these actions outside of Bell terms, without using the Bell Let's Talk hashtag, without even in the scope of Bell. We need to have these in the streets. We need to have these in hospitals. We need to have these in waiting rooms. And I will not allow anyone to be forced on a 6-month waiting list for therapy, on a 6-month waiting list to get subsidization for their medication, because that's not healthcare. That's Bell Let's Talk healthcare. And I'm not going to be talking about that.
See y'all in the streets.
Black Theater Workshop is proud to present the world premiere of a new play by Anne-Marie Woods, Scotian Journey, directed by Jamie Robinson. This is Black Theater Workshop's annual presentation for Black History Month and an official part of Montreal's Black History Month activities. From the Jamaican Maroons to the story of Africville, from Sierra Leone to the Black Loyalists, Scotian Journey addresses issues of racism and stereotypes in Nova Scotia's history that are still not in any of our history books. Scotian Journey plays for one public performance only on Saturday, February 16 at 3 p.m. at the Centre Culturel Georges Vanier, 2450 Workman Street. For tickets, call 514-932-1104 or email boxoffice@blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
Protests and Pedagogy, January 29th to February 11th, an event series and conference commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Concordia Computer Center occupation of 1969 when students challenged racial bias in grading, occupied the ninth floor computer center, and demanded justice. Panels, community forums, film screenings, walking tours, and an archival exhibit. Please visit protestsandpedagogy.ca. That's protestsandpedagogy.ca. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah. Like that. Like that. I would love your cock to be inside me. Oh, fuck. Oh, God. I'm really gonna come. I'm really gonna come. Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Can you see how wet I am? Can you see how wet I am? Oh, fuck. Yeah. 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 Oh, fuck.
It's time for Audio Smith. It's time for Audio Smith. Smith, 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 Smith. A queer, feminist, trans positive radio show about fucking in all its forms.
Four, five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content. So turn the volume all the way up.
Oh, that was so hot. I'm gonna pee for you now. Are you ready? Yeah, you wanna watch me pee? Oh, yeah, I'm gonna pee, yeah.